The technique of the decoy is used in negotiations to take the other person's attention away from what is the real issue. This is the person who offers a place a large contract with a manufacturer, providing they can deliver in a 90-day period. The manufacturer is very anxious to get the account. However, both sides know that there's no way they can deliver in a 60-day period. So finally, the buyer makes the concession. Well, this one time, we'll be willing to go along with a 90-day concession. But if we do that for you, the trade-off technique, if we do that for you, we want you to give us a 5% discount. In actual fact, the 5% was the real issue all along. The delivery date was just a decoy designed to take the other person's mind off the real issue. You'll recall in the example of negotiating the hotel room in Atlanta, the decoy used there was the fact that they had twin-size rooms, not a king-size bed available. That wasn't the real issue at all. Of course, what I wanted to accomplish was a reduction in the price of the room, but that took their attention away from the real thing. Now, a refinement of the decoy technique is the red herring. This is a decoy, an issue created in the negotiations, that will subsequently be used to trade off for a real issue. And the most famous example of the red herring technique being used was during the Korean War armistice talks. Senator Henry Jackson of Washington wrote an excellent book on these negotiations. They're very interesting to study, to see in retrospect the mistakes that were made. During the ceasefire period, it was agreed that neither side would rebuild the airstrips that were being used. It very quickly became apparent to the North Koreans that they had made a mistake, because we were still able to fly planes in from aircraft carriers, but they desperately needed to get the airstrips on the north side of the demilitarization zone rebuilt. So here's the technique that they used, the red herring that they pulled on us, to get that provision stricken from the agreement that we had made. They had previously agreed with us that on each side of the negotiating team, there would be three neutral countries represented at the talks. We had selected Norway, Sweden, Switzerland. They had selected Poland, Czechoslovakia, but had deferred on the choice of the third country. Later on, we found out why they'd held off on making this decision. Because when the airstrip issue came up, they said, well, we've now decided on our third neutral country. We have decided on Russia. We said, what do you mean, Russia? Russia's not neutral. That's the major communist power in the world. And they said, well, yes, but they're not directly involved in this conflict, so as far as we're concerned, we're neutral. They went through the same technique that your children might use on you. They wore us down by constant repetition of the question about the objection. Why would you object to Russia, they were saying. We would restate our position. But we don't understand. Why would that be a problem, they would say. Isn't this a lot like your son saying to you, Dad, why don't you want me borrowing the car tonight? Well, you borrowed the car last night. What's that got to do with this night? Well, I don't want you out all the time in the car. And finally, they wear you down by just constant repeating of the question. So finally, they said, well, we don't really understand why you won't let us have Russia on our team of negotiators. But I'll tell you what, here's what we're prepared to do. We'll forget about pushing Russia on the negotiating team if you'll forget about this dumb provision about not rebuilding the airstrips. And we ended up trading off a real issue, the airstrips, for a contrived issue, which was the point of view of putting Russia on the negotiating team, which they never expected to accomplish in the first place. So look out for this. The red herring is a decoy created to trade off for a real issue in the negotiations. I used to work for a man who was always using the decoy tactic on me. He would call me into his office and he'd just read the riot act on a particular issue. After I got to know him a little better, I knew that this was not the real issue that he had called me in for. The real issue was something to come down the line after he'd softened me up with the decoy issue. So be careful that you're negotiating the real issues in the negotiation, not decoys or red herrings. The puppy tug technique is a very interesting technique that you'll find used in negotiations, and salespeople call it the puppy dog close. It comes from the pet store owner who has a little boy who is not sure about buying the puppy. And he says to the little boy, well, why don't you take the puppy home over the weekend? If you don't like it, on Monday you can bring it back. Well, of course, over the weekend the little boy falls in love with the puppy and he's not about to bring it back. In England, as a teenager, I went to work selling televisions in a TV store. And we sold thousands of televisions using the puppy dog clothes. This was at a time when it was quite a luxury to have a television. This was in the mid-1950s, and a television in England was quite a luxury. If you had one, you were expected to invite your neighbors in to watch it in the evening. So we would say to people, well, fine, why don't you just take the television home with you, and you can use it for a week or so, and then if you don't like it, you can bring it back. Well, of course, having had the television for a week and invited their neighbors over to watch television, they were not about to send it back to the store. What's going on here is one negotiator getting the other person emotionally involved in the decision. And anything you can do that gets people emotionally involved helps you draw the negotiations to a satisfactory conclusion. Real estate salespeople, having shown a home to people, will say to the people as they're leaving, "Now, why don't you just wait a minute? I got a Polaroid camera in the car. I'd like to get a picture of you standing on the front doorstep." So they take a picture and they hand it to the people. And what do the people do? They take it to their friends and neighbors and say, "Look, this is the house that we made an offer on." Now, they're not about to back away from that later on when the negotiations get tough. And it makes it a lot easier for the real estate salesperson to get the concessions that they want in the negotiation. We mentioned briefly earlier the reluctant buyer principle. It would seem fairly obvious that if you approach a seller with enthusiasm, you're not going to get a very good buy. And yet it's amazing how often I see this rule being broken, particularly on car lots. I'll see someone go into a car lot and get so enthusiastic and excited about a particular make and model of car. They may pick out the colors, the upholstery, the options. They may even say to the salesperson, "Well, my car broke down today. I need something to get to working tomorrow." And then they expect to negotiate a good price. It simply doesn't work like that. Always play the reluctant buyer role. Whether you're buying something as an investor, or acquiring an automobile, or making a proposal to another company, or somebody's made a proposal to you, always play the reluctant buyer role. Well, quite frankly, I just don't think we'd be interested in this at this point in time. But I do appreciate you coming in and making a proposal to us. And just to be fair to you, what is the very lowest price that you would accept? Now, if you're not aware of what people are doing to you, you tend to give away your entire negotiating range before the negotiations even start. But good negotiators always play the reluctant buyer role. It's an attempt to squeeze down the negotiating range before the real negotiations even start. Conversely, look out for the reluctant seller role. I once knew a man who owned a tremendous amount of real estate. But whenever an agent bought him an offer on one of his properties, it was always his favorite property. "Oh," he'd say, "I'm kind of embarrassed about you bringing an offer in on that property. I've done so well with that, I was just about to take it off the market. I don't think it would make any sense for me to sell it at this point in time, and I certainly wouldn't be interested in anything less than the full asking price. But just to be fair to you," he would say, "since you were nice enough to bring me an offer, what is the very best price that you would give me?" Again, we go back to the fundamental understanding of real estate that makes you a good real estate negotiator, and that is that the pressure is always on the other side to compromise just as much as it is on you, and it never appears to be that way. You always think you've got the weaker hand in negotiations. So be aware of reluctant buyer and reluctant seller. Typically, the pressure is on them just as much as it is on you. Here's the want-it-all philosophy, which says that in your initial negotiation, you would always ask for far more than you expect to get. Not only because you may get some things that you otherwise would not achieve in the negotiations, but the real key issue here is that you're setting up a climate where the other person can win in the negotiations. Inexperienced negotiators tend to go in with their very best offer right at the start because they're not confident enough in what they're doing to do anything less than that. Good negotiators know that in order to set things up so the other people can win in the negotiations, then they should always ask for more than they expect to get so that they can let the other person win in the negotiation. You may notice that in the highly published negotiations, like when the football players go on strike or the airline pilots, the initial demands of both sides are absolutely outrageous. I remember being a consultant on a union negotiation once, and I just couldn't believe the initial demands. The initial demand of the union was to triple the wages of the employees. The initial demand of the company was to make it an open shop, in other words, a voluntary union, which would have in effect destroyed the power of the union completely with that company. But the initial demands in these type of negotiations are always way out. Then they work their way in towards the middle, they find a common ground, and then they can both call a press conference and announce that they won in the negotiations. An attorney friend of mine in Amarillo, Texas, once tested this theory for me. He was representing a buyer of a piece of real estate, and they had a fairly good deal worked out, but he thought, well, I'll see how this works. And they dreamt up 23 paragraphs of requests that they would make at the seller. Some of them were absolutely ridiculous. They felt sure that at least half of them would get thrown out right away. What actually happened was the seller of the property took strong objection to one of the sentences in one of the paragraphs, and my attorney friend, as I taught him, didn't give in right away. He held out for a couple of days before he finally reluctantly conceded. And even then, when he only gave away one sentence in 23 paragraphs of requests, the seller felt that they had won in the negotiations. So always leave some room to have the other person win. How should your initial offers be in negotiations? Are you better off to go in with a hard line, take it or leave it attitude with your very best offer? Well, my advice is to go in very, very low, but imply flexibility in the offer. Let's say that you are thinking about an automobile that's priced at $10,000. You think that $7,000 would be a fair price for it. I would suggest that rather than go in with a $7,000 offer, take it or leave it, you're better off to go in with a $6,000 offer, but imply flexibility. You see, if you go in with a $7,000, take it or leave it, it may antagonize the people so much that they're not even willing to go to the bargaining table with you. But if you go in with an attitude of, well, I haven't really had a chance to thoroughly check the car out yet, and I know this offer is going to be a lot less than you're hoping for, but based on everything I've seen so far, I really feel that $6,000 is a good offer for the car. Here it's a ridiculously low offer, but because you're implying flexibility, they have a tendency to think, well, it sounds as though we can get him up from that. Why don't we spend some time and see if we can get him up to a reasonable price? And it's a better way to get the negotiations started. Split in the difference. The rule is, never offer to split the difference yourself, but always encourage the other person to split the difference. Now let's say that you have been working on a contract, and you have been able to get the sellers of the contract down to $80,000, and you have come up to $76,000 with your offer. Where do you go from there? Here's the way you do it. You say, well, I guess this is just not going to fly. Seems like such a shame, though, when we've spent so much time negotiating this. We'll talk later about how people become more flexible in relationship to the time that they've invested in the negotiations. We spent so long on this proposal, we've come so far down the road, and it seems like a shame that it's going to fall apart when we're only $4,000 apart. If you keep stressing the time that you spent on it and the small amount of money that you're apart on the issue, sooner or later, the other people will say, well, look, why don't we split the difference? You, acting a little bit dumb, say, let's split the difference. What would that be? Well, I'm at 76, you're at 80, 79, 78. What you're telling me is you'd come down to 78? Is that what I hear you saying? Well, yes, they say, if you'll come up to 78, we'll just put the difference, we'll settle at that. Well, you say, 78 sounds a lot better than 80. Tell you what, let me talk to my partners, or whatever other higher authority you've set up. Let me talk to my partners and see how they feel about it. I'll tell them you came down to 78. We'll see if we can't put it together now. I'll get back to you tomorrow. The next day you get back to them and you say, boy, are they tough to deal with right now. I felt sure that I could get them to go along with 78, but we spent 3 hours last night going over the figures again and again and again. They're absolutely convinced that we can't come out if we go a penny over $76,000. But golly, we're only $2,000 apart on this thing now. Surely we're not going to let it all fall apart when we're only $2,000 apart. And if you keep that up long enough, sooner or later they'll offer to split the difference again. I was once negotiating with a bank that had a blanket encumbrance over several properties that I owned. I had sold one property out from the blanket. They were entitled to a $32,000 pay down of the loan. I offered them 28. I got them to offer to split the difference at 30. Over a period of weeks until this four-pex closed, I was able to get them to offer to split the difference again at 29 and at 28.5, and finally we resolved it at $28,250, simply doing what I'm telling you here. So the rule is, never offer to split the difference, but always encourage the other person to split the difference. Have you ever watched tennis on television and seen a highly emotional star like an Ely Anastasi or a John McEnroe jumping up and down at the other end of the court? You wonder to yourself, how on earth can anybody play tennis against somebody like that? It's such a game of concentration, it doesn't seem fair. Well, the answer to that is that good tennis players understand that only one thing affects the outcome of the game of tennis, and that's the movement of the ball across the net. What the other player is doing doesn't affect the outcome of the game at all, as long as you know what the ball is doing. So in that way, tennis players learn to concentrate on the ball, not on the other person. Now, when you're negotiating, the ball is the movement of the goal concessions across the negotiating table. It's the only thing that affects the outcome of the game. But it's so easy to get thrown off by what the other people are doing, isn't it? I remember once I was interested in acquiring a large real estate project. But I knew that I had to get the price down way below the $1.8 million that the sellers were asking for the property. It was owned free and clear by a large group of real estate investors. A real estate agent had brought it to my attention, so I felt obligated to let him present the first offer, reserving the right to go back and negotiate directly with the sellers if he wasn't able to get my $1.2 million offer accepted. Well, this was the last thing in the world the agent wanted to do, was to go in at $1.2 million, $600,000 below the asking price. But finally, I convinced him to give it a try, and off he went to present the offer. Now, you'll notice here that we've talked about the importance of negotiating in your own surroundings. He made a tactical error here. He should not have gone to them. He should have had them come to him. But anyway, he came back a few hours later, and I said, "How did it go?" And he said, "It was awful, just awful. I'm so embarrassed." He said, "I got into this large conference room, and all of the principals had come in for the reading of the offer. They had hired their attorney to come in, their CPA, their real estate broker was there. I got down to the $1.2 million, and they said, 'Wait a minute, you're coming in $600,000 low? We're insulted.' And they all got up and stormed out of the room." I said, "Nothing else happened?" He said, "Well, a couple of the principals stopped in the doorway on the way out, and they said, 'We're not going to come down to a penny less than $1.5 million.'" The real estate agent said, "It was just awful. Please don't ever ask me to present an offer that low again." I said, "Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that in 5 minutes you got them to come down $300,000 and you feel badly about the way the negotiations went? See how easy it is to get thrown off by what the other people are doing rather than the real issues in the negotiation. It's inconceivable that a full-time professional negotiator, say an international negotiator, would walk out of negotiations because he doesn't think the other people are fair. He may walk out, but it's as a specific negotiating tactic, not because he's upset. Can you imagine the top negotiator showing up in the White House and the president says, 'What are you doing here? I thought you were in Geneva negotiating with the Russians.' 'Well, yes, I was, Mr. President, but those guys are not fair. I just got so upset, I just walked out." Good negotiators don't do that. They concentrate on the issues, not on the personalities. Where are we now compared to where we were an hour ago, or yesterday, or last week? This is why salespeople will have this happen to them. They'll lose an account. They'll take it into their sales manager, and they'll say, "Hey, don't waste time on this. I did everything I could. If anybody could have saved it, I would have saved it. So don't waste any time trying to save it." And the sales manager will say, "Well, just as a public relations gesture, let me give them a call anyway." And the sales manager can hold it together, not necessarily because he's any brighter than the salesperson, because he hasn't become emotionally involved the way the salesperson has become. Don't do that. Concentrate on the issues. Always maintain perspective when you're negotiating. Don't get so carried away with the thought of getting an extra nickel or dime that you lose sight of the real key issues in the negotiation. Always be thinking to yourself when you're negotiating, how will this look a year from now? How does this fit into the scheme of things? See, sometimes people get so enthusiastic about negotiations that they're just negotiating for negotiation's sake. Now, that's fine when you're negotiating with little things just for practice in negotiations. But when you put aside a major deal, when you lose it because you got a little bit too greedy, then that's a big mistake. I remember 20 apartment units that I was interested in acquiring in Los Angeles in 1976. This was just before the market boomed and real estate doubled and tripled in price in Southern California. And they were asking $199,000 for these units, which was, in retrospect, an incredibly good price. I had managed to negotiate it down to an even better price, $177,000. And then I got a little bit greedy. The owner of the building had been living there as the resident manager, and he was going to move back east. And I thought to myself, I bet I can get him to leave the furniture in his apartment behind. That'll make it easier for me to get a resident manager into the building. And it doesn't look like much. It looks like a pile of junk anyway. It's probably costing more to ship it back east than it would just leave it. And, you know, I lost the entire building over negotiating over that stupid furniture. I didn't know it was family heirlooms that had been in his family for generations. It looked like junk to me. But he was so enraged about this change in the proposal that I lost the entire building. That building, which I could have bought for $177,000 in 1976, is probably worth around $600,000 now. And every time I drive by it, I think of this rule. Maintain perspective when you're dealing with people. Don't get so carried away with negotiating that you lose sight of the real issues that are important to you. In our next session together, we'll talk about power and how it affects the negotiations, why you sometimes feel intimidated by other people, and what you should do about it.
This is the end of side 6. Please fast forward the tape to the end to cue up side 5 for your next listening.